It's the MPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule for this Thursday, December 27th. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for your interest. Today on the podcast, we'll hear about the increasing use of fusion surgery to ease the pain of a bad back. Also, 150 years to the day from a mass execution of Dakota Indians in Mankato, the Dakota people return to the city to remember. And we'll hear about the collecting and selling of Minneapolis license plate data and a Minnesota farmer who's expanding his operation to Africa. First, that back surgery. Governor Dayton is having it today, and his prognosis for a quick recovery is good. On Morning Edition, Kathy Werzer talked with Dr. Christopher DeWald about spinal stenosis.
Well, spinal stenosis is a narrowing of the spinal canal. So basically, if you imagine, I like to think of it like a cable tie around a nerve sac, that as the bones tighten around the nerve sac, it starts to squeeze the nerves, frankly. And it typically is something that is described as maybe back pain, but a lot of times it's a heaviness or a weakness in the legs, very much like the governor has.
I mentioned that the NIH says it's pretty common, most common among folks who are 50 and older. Why is that?
It usually occurs mainly because of arthritis. And so as we all know, as we age, we develop more arthritis. And in the governor's case, he has a slippage between two vertebrae. And that slippage is related most commonly to degenerative spondylolisthesis. That's a big term, but frankly means that as the disc is degenerating, as all our spines do as we age, and one vertebrae slowly begins to slip on the other. And this is most common in the lower lumbar spine. So it's a combination of disc degeneration and arthritis in the posterior part of the spine.
When you fuse a vertebrae, how well does that tend to work in terms of a long-term fix for this spinal stenosis?
We hear a lot of bad things about spinal surgery, or at least some fears about spinal surgery. And in fact, this is a very rewarding surgery. And the reason it is because it's not so much the fusion that's important. It's the first step of the surgery is called a laminectomy or a decompression. What he's feeling is as the stenosis is occurring, the squeezing of the nerves makes the legs feel heavy because those little nerves that are going down into the legs. And it's a cutting off of those nerves that make those legs feel that way. So the first, I like to consider the surgery kind of as a two-step procedure. We do them simultaneously, but the most important step is the decompression, taking the pressure off the nerves. And you do that by removing the lamina, which is the posterior aspect of the spine. After you've done the laminectomy, though, because of that slippage between those two vertebrae, now it's going to slip even further if you don't fuse it. So the fusion comes as a secondary aspect of it.
Final question here. What does recovery look like for a surgery like this?
Well, usually the first day he's actually able to get up and take a couple of steps. And within a couple of days, usually walking around the hospital floor and hopefully home soon afterward. When you do a fusion, typically they stay in the hospital for a couple of days, mainly because there's a little bit more muscle that has to be cut in order to put the screws and rods in the spine, which we usually use for spinal fusion. And if you think about the screws and rods, although, again, many people think of that as kind of scary, obviously, but basically we're putting a screw into the vertebrae above the slippage area and one into the vertebrae below, and then a rod connects the two. And this is going to stop this vertebrae from further slipping. But that's just the instrumentation. The fusion itself comes from us from burring the bone with a high-speed burr to make the bone bleed. And we use some bone chips to allow the bone to heal one vertebrae to another to fuse. So think of the rods and the screws like a cast. It's holding the spine together as the bone is healing around it.
Thank you, Doctor. Good information. I appreciate your time this morning.
Well, thank you, Kelly.
Christopher DeWald is a back surgeon in Chicago. He talked with Kathy Werzer. Dakota Indians from all over North America were in Mankato yesterday to remember the largest mass execution in U.S. history. 150 years ago yesterday, 38 Dakota men were hanged for crimes allegedly committed in the 1862 U.S.-Dakota War. Mark Stile was at the Wednesday gathering.
The ceremony was held at Reconciliation Park, the site of the hangings in downtown Mankato. In recent years, it's become an annual gathering, but the 300 or so people who gather today, marking the 150th anniversary of the event, was probably the largest crowd the commemoration's ever seen. Among the participants, a group of Dakota horseback riders and supporters who left South Dakota 3 weeks ago for Mankato. The number of riders increased as the group moved east into Minnesota. There are more than 50 horses as the group entered downtown Mankato for the ceremony. One of the organizers of the horseback ride, Peter Lenkeek, told the crowd it was a wonderful sight for the riders to see the crowd gathered at the downtown Mankato event. He said the location is a historic reminder of probably the most important event in the Dakota people's history. The war in 1862 started after the U.S. government failed to keep promises spelled out in treaties signed with the Dakota. By the time the war started in August 1862, conditions were so desperate some Dakota were starving. After the conflict ended, there were calls for revenge against the Dakota, mainly because of the hundreds of civilians killed in the war. The 38 Dakota hanged were found guilty of various war crimes. Many historians believe their so-called trials were a sham. Peter Lenkeek says the injustice of the executions still haunt the Dakota today.
In 1862... those 38 were hung as criminals. They died because they were protecting the children, the women, our way of life. And for that, I am ever thankful.
Waka, waka, koka, heya, che, waki, yelo, hai.
There were calls for reconciliation at the commemoration event in Mankato to heal lingering wounds on both sides left over from 1862. Minnesota State Representative Dean Erdahl, a Grove City Republican who studied and written about the war, called the conflict Minnesota's greatest tragedy. After the 1862 war, the Dakota were exiled from the state to Nebraska, South Dakota, and other locations. Erdahl said the only way true healing can take place is for all citizens to educate themselves about the events that led up to the war.
Unfortunately, what happened in Minnesota in 1862 received scant attention nationally, and still today is not given the attention that it deserves.
During today's ceremony, participants dedicated a new monument at the hanging site, displaying the names of the 38 Dakota executed in 1862. Mankato resident David Braveheart is a descendant of the Dakota survivors of 1862. He says his family demonstrates that reconciliation between the races is possible. Braveheart said his wife Sarah is descended from settlers who died in the 1862 war. The two have organized seminars to educate people about Dakota history.
It's hard to forgive. It's hard to be compassionate. It's hard to walk that path after all that we have been through.
Braveheart family sang their rendition of the song the Dakota men sang on the gallows while they awaited execution. The 150th anniversary of the war and the hangings has brought unprecedented attention to Dakota history. And while that may subside in the future, the annual ceremony in Mankato will continue each December. So will the horseback ride from South Dakota through southern Minnesota. Organizers say the event has become too important to them to drop, even though the landmark 150th anniversary of the events is over.
That was Mark Stile in Mankato. It's another anniversary, 4 weeks since police officer Thomas Decker was killed outside a Cold Spring bar. Conrad Wilson says not much appears to be gained in the investigation.
Police say Decker was ambushed while responding to concerns about a possibly suicidal man who lived above Winter's Bar in Cold Spring. The man was arrested, but police released him for lack of evidence. Last week, police held a news conference where they talked about a dark-colored van seen leaving the crime scene, but say they aren't sure if there's any link. They're also still looking for a 20-gauge shotgun they believe was used to kill Decker. Decker's death is the first fatal shooting of a Minnesota law enforcement officer since 1970 that was not solved within a few days.
Conrad Wilson on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Amy Sensor's attorney filed an appeal yesterday to reverse her conviction on two counts of criminal vehicular homicide. Rupa Shenoy has more.
Sensor's attorney, Eric Nelson, filed an appeal saying the prosecution didn't provide enough evidence at trial earlier this year to prove Sensor knew she hit Anna Song Panthavong on a freeway ramp in August 2011. Nelson also contends that if Sensor's conviction isn't overturned, she should get a new trial because of mistakes made by trial judge Daniel Mabley. He says Mabley should have sequestered the jury or allowed a change in venue. And he says jurors should have been told about the victim's toxicology reports. He says that would have allowed Sensor to argue she wasn't the sole cause of the accident. Sensor, the wife of former Minnesota Viking Joe Sensor, has been serving 41 months in prison for Panthavong's death. A spokesman for the Hennepin County Attorney's Office declined to comment, saying they received the brief too late in the day. Rupa Shenoy, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minnesota Congressman Colin Peterson says lawmakers should allow the current farm bill to lapse in order to get a new farm bill with better provisions for dairy farmers. Peterson, a DFLer, is the ranking member of the House Agriculture Committee. He doesn't expect the farm bill to pass this year, and he says he doesn't support an extension of the current farm bill.
Co-ops that control 80% of the milk in this country, they are with me in not wanting an extension because we need a new dairy policy. If we just extend the current law, we're going to be another year under a system that doesn't work. So we think we've kind of got to create a crisis here to get people to move.
If the farm bill is not renewed, Peterson says milk prices at the store will probably take several months to rise. Academics and entrepreneurs have received copies of a massive database the Minneapolis Police Department uses to track the location of cars. The data comes from the city's network of automatic license plate readers. Those are cameras that record the locations of hundreds of thousands of cars every month. Curtis Gilbert tells us why the information is public and what might be done with it.
Minneapolis has received at least 100 requests for data from its license plate scanners over the last 5 months. Most came from people who wanted to know where the scanners had spotted an individual license plate. And more than a third of them came from one man, Alex Peterson. He repossesses cars for a living.
I see a license plate hit in this neighborhood, and I do work on the internet and find out that they have a relative that lives in that neighborhood and find it at that address. There's a lot of different ways I can use the information.
Minnesota law makes all data collected by the government public unless it's specifically classified otherwise. So Minneapolis dutifully turned over the information to anyone who asked. But earlier this month, the city abruptly changed its approach. It asked the state to issue an order rendering the data private for the next 2 years while it lobbies the legislature to change the law. Susan Siegel is the city attorney.
It became clear to us that this was creating a real risk to public safety.
Siegel says the license plate readers are designed to help the police find criminals and stolen cars, but in the wrong hands, the data they collect could be used to commit crimes.
Victims of domestic abuse, for example, don't want their batterers to know where they're living or where they may be working.
The city was also concerned about the increasing amounts of data being requested. In addition to the inquiries about specific license plates, Minneapolis also received numerous requests for the entire database. Earlier this month, it released a file containing some 2.1 million records covering a three-month period. Nine people received the database. One of them was Mark Pitts. He lives in Rogers, and he's finishing up a master's degree in statistics.
And so I thought it would be an interesting data set for my master's project. And it turned out to be a very interesting data set, as you know.
Eight of the license plate scanners are attached to police cars. So Pitt says they don't just record the locations of the vehicles around them. They also record the movements of the police.
You can literally see everywhere they went. I can tell you where they stopped for lunch. I can tell you when they met at the hospital. There's a lot more operational information about their activities and movements in this data than there are about any single individual.
That's why Pitt supports making the data private. But some of the other people who've examined the database disagree. Arthur D'Antonio is a California-based web developer. He's exploring whether the data have commercial applications.
I personally believe that the data shouldn't be being stored on innocent people at all. But I also believe that if it is, that we're paying for that. And so you know, I think anybody should be able to go and use it for whatever legal purpose that they want to use it for.
D'Antonio hasn't figured out exactly how to make money using the data, but he says the fact that automobile repossession companies have been using it suggests one possibility.
Is there any way we could have made it so that that guy could have obtained that data quicker, more efficiently, maybe even on the go? That makes his business that much more successful. He can maybe hire more people. If there's opportunity, I think everybody should be looking to seize it.
But researchers and entrepreneurs looking for opportunities in the license plate scanner database may have missed their chance, at least for now. A recently issued administrative order classifies the data as private for at least the next 3 months. It applies to Minneapolis and any other Minnesota cities that collect this data, and the legislature will likely consider whether to make the data private permanently.
That's Curtis Gilbert in the Twin Cities. The Boys and Girls Clubs of the Twin Cities says an unexpected donation could allow the organization to maintain programs and the hours its facilities are open. The organization announced last week it was closing for 2 weeks and furloughing nearly 80 employees. The Boys and Girls Clubs faced a $300,000 deficit this fall, and year-end donations were another $300,000 short. Clubs President Aaron Carlin says an anonymous donor came forward with $50,000 the organization has until the end of next week to match.
This gift, if we can match it, it certainly will help us to make payroll and keep our doors open. So we will go into January in a position that we'll be able to spend the time really securing other gifts as well. It would make a huge difference.
Carlin says the number of young people attending the club's 8 locations on a daily basis has increased by 12% over the past year, while donations have actually dropped. A coalition of nonprofits and corporations fighting hunger in Minnesota says it has contributed more than 36 million meals to those in need since its launch in 2011. Judy Mann is a spokeswoman for Hunger Free Minnesota. She says the group is on track to fill what it calls the meal gap by 2015.
Research has shown us that hungry Minnesotans miss a total of 100 million meals every year. So that has been our goal, is to add 100 million meals sustainably per year.
Mann says Hunger Free Minnesota has added meals to the system by signing more eligible Minnesotans up for food stamps and by obtaining surplus produce from Minnesota farm fields. One place there's been hunger but doesn't need to be is Africa. And a Red River Valley farmer has a plan to do something about it. He's expanding his operation to Mozambique. The farmer and other investors, many from Minnesota, are part of a corporation investing millions to develop farmland in Africa, so says Dan Gunderson.
Farming success is in Wally Hardy's blood. His great-grandfather settled on the rich farmland of the Red River Valley. The operation has done well, growing corn, soybeans, and grains. But now Hardy is putting his farming expertise to work in Mozambique.
Maybe I should show you a map.
Hardy spreads out a large map of Africa on the desk in his farm office.
This is where our farm is right now, pretty remote.
Remote means no electricity, dirt roads, and land that's mostly tree and brush covered. Hardy and his son go there several times a year to work and to share their farming expertise. Hardy sees a lot of potential. He's part of an investment group called Aslan Global Management that's been given a long-term lease on 25,000 acres of land by the Mozambique government. Many countries and corporations have taken advantage of land concessions in Africa to expand crop production. They often export all of the crops, and local residents see little benefit. Critics call those concessions a land grab or neocolonialism. Hardy says the investment group intends to make a profit, but he says profit isn't the only reason he wants to farm in Africa. His interest started after his daughter served as a medical missionary in Africa about 5 years ago. When Hardy visited her, he was troubled by the poverty and hopelessness.
The bottom line is that we'd like to do some good here. The thing that tears my heart out is people, especially men, sitting by the side of the road doing nothing, staring out into space. That's the thing that motivates me to do this. They're just asking for a shot. You know, they're willing to work hard. Just give me a chance to get some education. Give me a chance to be an apprentice to a farmer.
Hardy says the plan is to develop a large, intensive agriculture system. The organization will use profits to help local residents start their own farms. Last spring, the farm harvested its first soybean crop on a few hundred acres. This year, Hardy says they're planning a larger crop, Most of the soybeans will be sold to local chicken farmers. Hardy says the climate is perfect. The area gets 40 inches of rain a year. The land is fertile. The biggest challenge is earning the trust of local residents.
You know, you got to burn up a lot of brain cells. You got to do this right. You know, you just don't, you don't push it, you don't force it, and you got to get the community buy-in. Right now, you know, big is assumed to be bad until you prove otherwise.
Hardy says the group is hiring local workers and making investments in local projects, like a new well for a nearby village. They plan to work with other nonprofit groups to develop a medical clinic, a school, and a microloan program to help local residents start farming. Minnesota native Paul Larson is co-founder of Aslan Global Management. He says the organization is faith-based, and its stated mission is earning a profit for investors and doing social good.
It's very important for us to not be in Africa to extract wealth. We're in Africa to create wealth or to create value. And that's a very big distinction between what we're doing and what others do.
Larson says most of the investors, many from the Midwest, are successful business owners who want investments that also make a difference. It'll take about 5 years before the investors start seeing a financial return.
Well, $25 million into this Mozambique operation, more than that, $25 to $30 million in this particular farm. But of course, what would a 25,000-acre soybean farm cost in Minnesota?
Larson says it costs about $1,200 an acre to get the land cleared and the farm set up. But he says that's a bargain compared with land in Minnesota, which is selling for anywhere from $6,000 to $10,000 an acre. Larson says the group is already expanding. They've leased 98,000 acres in Tanzania, and they're negotiating a lease on another farm in Mozambique.
Sub-Saharan Africa has enough land to feed five times its population, but currently it's dependent on other countries for two-thirds of its food. Our view is if we can come alongside with capital and some know-how, they will be feeding a very large chunk of the world 20 or 25 years from now.
Red River Valley farmer Wally Hardy is convinced African farms can be even more productive than the best American farms. That's why he's trying to convince his farming friends to join the land rush in Africa.
That's Dan Gunderson in Fairmount, North Dakota, on the NPR News Update. Friday news on your schedule right here tomorrow. And Phil Picardi, thanks for dialing up the podcast today.